Discarding a composite picture of the 20th century's greatest minds, in which Sigmund Freud is portrayed as analysing Albert Einstein, which of course he never did, Freud has appeared four times on the cover of Time magazine since its creation in 1923. Freud made his first entry on the 27th of October 1924 on the occasion of the recent American publication of Beyond the Pleasure Principle and Group Psychology and the Analysis of the Ego. In English translations by Miss C.J. M. Hubbock and James Strachey. The caption underneath the charcoal drawing by Samuel Johnson Wolfe read, I don't think you'll be able to read it, even I can't read it from here. The caption read, quote, "The only rogue in a company of immaculate rascals," unquote, which was taken from the magazine's article on Freud and Freudism, in which the anonymous author, because Time magazine articles were written anonymously, in which the anonymous author claimed that this is how the great apostle of psychoanalysis had once referred to himself. Some 15 years later, on the 26th of June 1939, Freud featured again on the cover of Time, following the American release of Moses and Monotheism. This time with the caption, and again you wouldn't be able to read it, this time with the caption, "Ancestors ride in our buses." A line which had been freely adapted from the 1867 novel The Guardian Angel by Oliver Wendell Holmes. Quote, "We are all omnibuses in which our ancestors ride, and every now and then one of them sticks his head out and embarrasses us." Unquote. The anonymous author of the article in Time now designated Freud as, quote, "an intellectual provocateur, a disturber of human complacency," who had politely declined an offer from his New York-based nephew Edward Bernays, the so-called father of public relations, to spend the last years of his life in America, opting instead for a peaceful exile in London, where, according to the author, he had recently completed his cyclical study of antisemitism. Moses and monotheism is full of logical holes, doubtful history, and fanciful anthropology, the author proclaimed. Quote, "But it still remains a bold attempt in pioneering a dark continent," unquote. To the best of my knowledge, Time did not run a feature when Freud died, a mere 3 months after this second cover story. Yet a watercolour and gouache portrait of Freud by Ben Shahn appeared on the cover of Time on the 23rd of April 1956. On the occasion of the centenary of Freud's birth. Under the title The Explorer, the corresponding essay inside presented a fairly balanced survey of Freud's main discoveries, highlighting the pervasive presence of psychoanalytic ideas in American psychiatric practice, as well as the extraordinary penetration of Freudian insights, both in the public sphere and in the widest range of professional environments. While simultaneously quoting the bright, up-and-coming British psychologist Eysenck as saying, quote, "I have yet to meet a Freudian who can prove that there is a higher improvement rate among neurotics who are psychoanalyzed," unquote. Of the Freud covers of Time, the most interesting one appeared on the 29th of November 1993. It shows a computer-generated image of Freud, his head transformed into a three-dimensional jigsaw puzzle, which is falling apart. Partly because of the mysterious open-ended question, "Is Freud dead?" Partly because of the provocative contents of the article by Paul Gray, the articles were no longer anonymous, the article by Paul Gray to which it referred. Under the title The Assault on Freud, Gray charted no less than four distinct contemporary forces that were shaking the Freudian foundations in 1993. The recovered memory therapy scandals, the unstoppable proliferation of psychotropic drugs, the newly introduced healthcare economics of the Clinton administration, and the trenchant anti-Freudian arguments formulated by Adolf Grünbaum and others. Gray questioned when the, under these circumstances psychoanalysis had the capacities to survive. Admitting that Freud's invention still, quote, feels closer to the experience of living and therefore hurting than any other system, and that psychoanalysis would be missed if it disappeared, leaving nothing in its place, unquote, Gray nonetheless concluded that psychoanalysis, quote, may in the final analysis turn out to be no more reliable than phrenology or mesmerism or any of the countless other pseudosciences that once offered unsubstantiated answers or false solace, unquote. As if this had been an unequivocal declaration of Freud really being dead, which required not only time for reflection, but also some further investigation into the circumstances of his death, Time's rival magazine Newsweek responded with its own cover story and a full dossier on the state of health of psychoanalysis, including an interview with Nobel Prize laureate Eric Kandel on the 27th of March 2006, heralding the 150th anniversary of Freud's birth. Turning Time's question from 1993 into a firm statement, the Newsweek editor decided to add a negation, declaring that Freud is not dead. Because although, the editor said, quote, the couch is out, the culture of therapy is everywhere, and science is taking a new look at Freud's theories, unquote. The latter point summarized the contents of an extended essay by Mark Solms, who was actually here a couple of days ago giving a talk at a museum, published some 2 years earlier in Scientific American, in which Solms, the renowned neuropsychologist, had demonstrated how many of the world's most respected neuroscientists were turning to psychoanalysis again as a broad intellectual framework for their ideas. After Time had insinuated in 1993 that Freud was dead, Scientific American, by virtue of Solms, claimed in 2004 that Freud returns, which subsequently prompted Newsweek to declare in 2006 that Freud is not dead. Now, were it not for the fact that we know that Freud shared the destiny of all human beings, and did die on Saturday, the 23rd of September, 1939, the day of Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement, the holiest day of the Jewish calendar, here in his London home at 20 Maresfield Gardens. Were it not for the fact that we know that Freud did die, one could be led to believe that between 1993 and 2006, he had entered the gallery of the living dead, resurrected or zombified, depending on one's convictions. Were it not for the fact that we know that Freud was cremated on Tuesday the 26th of September at Golders Green Crematorium in the presence of his wife, five of his children, Sophie had died earlier, and a plethora of dignitaries, one could be led to believe that towards the end of the 20th century, serious doubt was being cast over the ontological stages of his body, that of his works, for sure, but also that of his intellectual legacy and that of his influence. Were it not for the fact that we know that Freud's ashes were interred at Golders Green Crematorium, Golders Green Columbarium, in a magnificent ancient Greek urn, which had been given to him by Princess Marie Bonaparte, and which had been a centerpiece of his study in Vienna for many years, one could be led to believe that 50 years after the events, the Americans were not at all sure whether his passing should be disputed or confirmed, whether his spirit would live on under socioeconomic conditions of neoliberal rationality in a world driven by evidence-based medicine, cost-effectiveness evaluations, and value-for-money principles. One could definitely be led to believe all of this, were it not for the fact that we know when, where, and how Freud the man had died. When, where, and how his heart had stopped beating, if not metaphorically, as a theoretical and clinical paradigm, at least literally, in the physical space of his already ailing body. And yet, surprising as this may seem, we don't really know at all. More than 75 years and some 20-odd biographies after Freud's demise, the facts in the case of Sigmund Freud's death remain strangely unclear. In its edition of Monday, the 25th of September 1939, The Times stated, quote, "Professor Sigmund Freud, M.D., originator of the science of psychoanalysis, died at his son's home, at his son's London home in Hampstead on Saturday night at the age of 83, unquote. However, on the day of Freud's cremation, the Birmingham Mail ran a short article on Ernest Jones's tribute to Freud at the funeral ceremony, which referred to, quote, "Professor Freud, the psychoanalyst who died in London on Sunday," unquote. 2 days later, on Thursday the 28th of September 1939, our local newspaper, the Hampstead News, published an obituary of one of its most famous residents, in which it was reported, quote, that Professor Sigmund Freud, the originator of psychoanalysis, died on Saturday at the home of his son in St. John's Wood, unquote. Foreign newspapers were equally conflicting in their coverage. On the 25th of September 1939, the Irish Independent released a statement saying that Freud, quote, died at his London home on Saturday, unquote. On the same day, the Irish Daily Telegraph also reported that Freud had died at his Hampstead London home shortly before midnight on Saturday. Yet this was contradicted by the Cork Examiner 2 days later, in which it was stated that Freud had died in London on Sunday. Some newspapers on the continent, such as the Belgian daily Het Laatste Nieuws, informed their readers that Freud had died during the night from Saturday into Sunday. Whereas the right-wing Parisian Action Française repeated that Freud had died on Saturday, and other papers, such as the Escher Tageblatt, simply mentioned Freud has died. Now, it goes without saying that newspapers are not the most reliable sources when it comes to establishing the facts. Yet puzzling discrepancies as to the date and the time of Freud's death reappear in the numerous biographies and personal memoirs of Freud. In her private journal, which awaits publication and remains closed to researchers, Marie Bonaparte noted that Freud had died at 23.45 hours on the 23rd of September. And in 1957, Ernest Jones wrote accordingly in the third volume of his exhaustive biography that Freud had died just before midnight, September 23rd, 1939. However, some 10 years later, Freud's physician, Max Shaw, contradicted Jones' account in his posthumously published Freud Living and Dying, in which he claimed that Freud had actually died at 3 a.m. on Saturday the 23rd, 1939. Over the years, Shaw's timing of Freud's death has come to be accepted by many Freud historians as the most accurate version. Despite the fact that Freud had never, that Shaw had never mentioned it previously in any of the documents of Freud's medical history he had compiled, and that he had only disclosed it once before, in his Freud lecture of the 19th of May 1964 to the New York Psychoanalytic Society on the problem of death in Freud's writings and life. The problem of death. But so, 3 a.m. on the 23rd of September 1939, it can now be found in the authoritative biographical studies by Ronald Clark, Peter Gay, Freud, A Life for Our Time, Michael Molnar, in his diary of Sigmund Freud, which is meticulously researched, mentions 3 a.m., Matthew von Unwert in Freud's Requiem mentions 3 a.m., Mark Edmondson in The Death of Sigmund Freud mentions it, and most recently, Elisabeth Roudinesco in Sigmund Freud, dans, En son temps et dans le nôtre, mentions 3 a.m. The overriding reason as to why Shaw's version has been deemed truthful and exact is that he is believed to have been present on the last day of Freud's life, acting as Freud's personal physician, for which he had received, so he says, official permission from the Home Office, providing his patient with medical care until the very end. Nonetheless, Shaw's presence at Freud's deathbed can be disputed on three separate grounds. First of all, the certified copy of Freud's entry of death in the register of the Metropolitan Borough of Hampstead, which is held here in the archives of the Freud Museum, it states that Freud's death occurred on the 23rd of September 1939 at 20 Maresfield Gardens, and that the cause of death, to which I shall return quite extensively, was certified by G.G. Exner, M.R.C.S. Georg Exner was a young, London-based maxillofacial oral surgeon, the former assistant of Professor Hans Pichler, Freud's oral surgeon in Vienna, to whom Freud had been referred by Pichler for the treatment of his cancer after his arrival in London in early June 1938. If Shaw had been present when Freud drew his last breath, why would Exner have been called in to certify his death? Why would Freud's youngest son Ernst, here mentioned as Ernest, why would Freud's youngest son Ernst, the person who registered his father's death, and who according to the death certificate was present at the death, declare that a surgeon by the name of Exner had certified it if another official medical doctor by the name of Shaw had actually witnessed it? Why, in short, does Exner's name appear on Freud's death certificate rather than Shaw's? The answer to this question may come from the rather unexpected, although not wholly unlikely source, that is Freud's dedicated housekeeper of 10 years, Paula Fichtel, also known as Die Paula and Die Kleine. Here we see her playing with Jumbo, hardly a big dog, but playing with Jumbo in the garden of Maresfield Gardens. Here we see her many years later, holding a lovely Venetian glass that was given to her by the Freud family. Here, Paula Fichtel in the kitchen. And here we see her standing in front of the house when Anna Freud was still alive. We know this because Anna hated the bushes being trimmed. So they only became trimmed and neat after she passed away. Paula Fichtel, who carried on working at 20 Maresfield Gardens until Anna Freud's death in 1982, when she returned to her native Austria. During the late 1960s and early 70s, a German journalist by the name of Detlef Bertelsen informally interviewed Die Paula on various occasions, which many years later resulted in the publication of Alltag bei Familie Freud, Freud, die Erinnerungen der Paula Fichtel, which contains Bertelsen's integrated narrative of Fichtel's scattered memories of over 50 years of personal service to the Freud family. In Bertelsen's words, Fichtel had at one point recalled how in September 1939, quote, Shaw is in possession of a temporary entrance visa for the USA and is desperate to make it onto the next ship because he's in a state of panic about the German invasion, unquote. And so, she continues to Bertelsen, quote, on the morning of the 23rd of September, after having administered a small dose of morphine to the already fading patient, he grabs, Shaw that is, he grabs his suitcase and rushes to the nearest train station, unquote. As to Herr Professor himself, according to Fichtel, he had died shortly after 3 in the morning, more than 36 hours after the injection. In his meticulously researched biography of Freud, Peter Gay mentions that he saw proof of Detlefsen's book, but, quote, the whole unchecked recollections of an aged servant is not a document to be trusted implicitly, unquote. And indeed, it cannot possibly be true that Shaw gave an injection on the morning of the 23rd of September and that Freud died at 3 a.m. more than 36 hours later. Because this would imply that Freud didn't die until the early hours of Monday morning, which can be disputed both on the basis of the death certificate and through the contents of various letters of condolence that were sent to Anna Freud after news of Freud's death was broken. You probably won't be able to read this. For example, on the 25th of September, Paul Bergman wrote to Anna Freud from Honolulu in Hawaii, saying that he had read the news of her father's death in the local newspapers the day before. Some letters of condolence, such as the one sent by Marjorie Brearley from Reading, are dated 24th of September, although you see that Marjorie Brearley seemed to be confused about the date. She seemed to have corrected the 25th into the 24th. But Marjorie Brearley wrote, "Dear Miss Freud, my husband and I were very sorry indeed to hear the announcement of your father's death this morning. We assume that she heard it on the radio, because obviously there was no television." Fichtel may have been mistaken as to the timing of Shaw's injection, but this does not necessarily mean that she was wrong about the other things as well. Were we to assume, for example, that Shaw injected Freud with morphine late morning on the 21st rather than the 23rd, then the interval of more than 36 hours could still coincide with Freud's death at 3 a.m. on the Saturday. Also assuming, of course, that this is indeed when he died. In addition, we know from ship records that Max Shaw and his family did sail to America in early October 1929. So Fichtel may have been right when she remembered his being in a rush during that last week of September. It may very well be true that Shaw wasn't there in Freud's dying moments, which may explain why his name doesn't appear on the death certificate and why he didn't mention an exact time of death in any of his memoranda on Freud's medical case history prior to 1964, when he delivered the 14th annual Freud lecture to the New York Psychoanalytic Society. Unreliable as the recollections of an aged servant may be, Shaw's absence on Yom Kippur 1939 at 20 Maresfield Gardens has been confirmed, although not in writing, by Dr. Josephine Stross. A pediatrician who had become friends with Anna Freud in 1923 and who had replaced Shaw as Freud's personal physician during the long journey in early June 1938 from Vienna to London. Shaw was incapacitated. He had to be rushed to hospital because he was suffering with appendicitis. Strauss subsequently also settled in London, looking after children at the Hampstead nurseries and acting as personal physician to Anna and her companion Dorothy Burlingham until their deaths. Sometimes Anna referred to Josephine Strauss as Fifi Strauss. Yet, as if to safeguard the need for professional distance, she would always address her as Dr. Strauss whenever she would ask for her medical advice. When Josephine Strauss died, a small monument in her honour was erected in a flower bed in the garden of the Freud Museum. You can see it here in the garden. Speaking to my friend Michael Molnar, who was employed as a researcher in residence at the Freud Museum during the early 90s, Strauss broadly corroborated Fichtel's account of the events, although she was much more dismissive than the housekeeper, in that she called Shaw a coward. A coward who had been unable to cope with Freud's agony and who had run off to America. At the same time, as we shall see, Strauss firmly put herself in the picture as the physician who was there in the hour of Freud's death. And in doing so, she again confirmed Fichtel's recollections, yet her presence at Freud's deathbed can also be substantiated through a number of other materials. For example, on the 8th of October, 1939, Dorothy Burlingham wrote a letter to Josephine Strauss from New York in which she stated, quote, "Anna," that's Anna Freud, Anna Freud wrote to me of you in those last days, and I'm so glad you were there to help, unquote. Some 10 years later, on the 12th of December 1949, Anna Freud sent a letter in German to Josephine Strauss after she received the news of the death of Strauss's brother, in which she wrote, this is Anna Freud, quote, "All I can say is that you should never forget that you can rely on me and the entire house here as some kind of family. We set out together, we worked together, and we have seen my father dying. It is as if we have shared a childhood together," unquote. And on the 12th of October 1964, Anna Freud wrote to Max Shaw in German about the manuscript of his lecture of the 19th of May at the New York Psychoanalytic, which he allegedly wanted to get published as a preview to the book. Not sure you can read it. I won't read it in the German. The English translation runs as follows. It says, quote, "Masoud Khan tells me that you want to publish your lecture as a foretaste to the book in the journal. He's very glad about this, and I shall ignore the fact that it's still very difficult for me." She means the death of her father. "Just one small remark. Shouldn't Dr. Strauss be mentioned in it? She was indispensable. Er war sehr unentbehrlich," it says. Sehr unentbehrlich. "Auf die Reise und in die letzten Nächten," die sie ganz geteilt hatte. "She was very indispensable during the journey and during the last couple of nights, which she shared fully," unquote. If Shaw was in the best possible position to comment on the circumstances of Freud's death, because he'd been there until the end, why would Anna Freud need to remind him of Dr. Strauss's involvement? Why would Shaw fail to mention Dr. Strauss's presence in his lecture on Freud's death, which for some reason never got published, if he himself had been there to witness everything? More intriguingly, despite Anna Freud's explicit recommendation here, Shaw never, ever wrote Josephine Strauss into his narrative of Freud's dying hours. Neither in the final draft of his book, nor for that matter, in any other of his preparatory memoranda. Nor did Peter Gay, despite the fact that he had access to the cited correspondence, that he saw the proofs of Bertelsmann's book, and that he actually corresponded with Josephine Strauss. When Michael Molnar's Diary of Sigmund Freud was released in 1992, it mentioned Josephine Strauss as the one who had replaced Shaw during the journey from Vienna to London. To the best of my knowledge, it doesn't mention Josephine Strauss as someone who had been present during Freud's last days. When Mark Edmondson published The Death of Sigmund Freud in 2007, it was once again Shaw's account of the events that was retold. Strauss's presence and Shaw's absence at Freud's deathbed was not given proper consideration until 2008. When an American medical doctor called Roy B. Lacoussière published the results of the first detailed investigation into the circumstances surrounding Freud's death. Yet in the most recent Freud biography by Elisabeth Roudinesco, Sigmund Freud en son temps et à l'autre, Shaw's version once again prevails. Insofar as his early departure from the scene is thrown into doubt by Roudinesco, and Lacoussière is berated for daring to believe Fichtel's story. Roudinesco mentions, this was published last year, that more will be revealed about what happened once the Josephine Strauss correspondence at the Freud Museum becomes accessible. Strangely enough, to the best of my knowledge, the Strauss archives were never closed in the first place to researchers. And what they reveal is that in all likelihood, the housekeeper was telling the truth when she said that Freud had died peacefully, surrounded by four dedicated women. Martha Freud, Anna Freud, herself, Paula Fichtel, and Josephine Strauss. Although I have no conclusive proof, I think Shaw left Maresfield Gardens sometime during the early afternoon of Thursday the 21st of September 1939. After which Martha and Anna Freud decided to call in the trusted Dr. Strauss, who lived nearby, as Shaw's replacement. Which also explains why Anna Freud wrote to Shaw in 1964 that Dr. Strauss had been sehr unentbehrlich, very indispensable, during the last couple of nights, i.e. the night from Thursday to Friday and the night from Friday to Saturday. You'll probably notice that this actually is underlined. I'm not going to elaborate on that, but we can talk about that in the discussion. I'm sure Michael will have things to say about that as well. We know from Shaw's, it's obviously not my underlinings, obviously not. Obviously not. We know from Shaw's book that on Thursday the 21st of September, this is Freud Living and Dying, which some of you may have read. We know from Shaw's book that on Thursday the 21st of September, Freud reminded him of the pact they had made previously, and on which they had shaken hands during their first meeting at the Berggasse, sometime towards the end of 1928. Back then, Freud had said to the young Dr. Max Shaw, quote, "Promise me one more thing, that when the time comes, you will not let me suffer unnecessarily," unquote. Now, in 1939, 11 years later, Freud repeated the phrase from his sickbed, which had been installed downstairs to the back area of the study. Downstairs. Literally, downstairs. Partly because it was slightly better protected against the German air raids, partly because Freud was already too frail to walk and was made to feel comfortable on a small couch, not this one, but we do have it, on a small couch facing the garden amongst his beloved books and antiquities. Quote, "My dear Shaw, you certainly remember our first talk. You promised me then not to forsake me when my time comes. Now it's nothing but torture and makes no sense anymore. Das ist jetzt nur noch Quälerei und hat keinen Sinn mehr." Still according to Shaw, after he received the reassurance from his doctor that he hadn't forgotten, Freud responded by saying, "I thank you." And more crucially, "Tell Anna about this." The last sentence here, "Tell Anna about this," which also appears almost verbatim in Jones's biography of Freud, may be apocryphal. Or at least, it may contain a significant distortion of Freud's last words. To be sure, the words are identical to those appearing in a typescript entitled The Medical Case History of Sigmund Freud, which is available from the Library of Congress in Washington, which Shaw had prepared during the early 1950s as a historical record of Freud's illnesses, and which he had hoped to see included as the final chapter of Jones' biography. This is the typescript that Shaw sent to Freud, to Anna Freud, in April 1954, after having sought legal advice about issues of confidentiality, and which Anna subsequently passed on to Ernest Jones. Yet in correspondence with both Anna Freud and Jones, Shaw indicated that this typescript contained a number of what he called unavoidable distortions, and that it should be read alongside two other records, what he called an original version, which had described the facts accurately, apart from some issues he said that had to remain inaccurate, and an accurate description, which he was depositing in the archives. These are the archives in Washington. Now, looking at the documents in the Max Shaw papers in the Library of Congress, it is not at all clear which version of Freud's medical case history qualifies as the most accurate description. Yet in Shaw's handwritten copy of the text, which I will refer to as the manuscript, Freud's last words are recorded differently. This is what Shaw wrote in the manuscript. Quote, "Discuss it with Anna. And if she thinks it's right, then make an end of it." Unquote. Now, were this account to be fully accurate, it would imply that it was actually Anna Freud who had made the final decision to see her father's life being brought to an end, and that for obvious reasons, Shaw would have wished to avoid implicating Freud's daughter in his death. Were it to be fully accurate, and Freud's death were to have been a case of assisted dying performed by his medical doctor with his youngest daughter's acquiescence, it would explain why the oral surgeon, Georg Exner, had been summoned to cover things up and certify the cause of death as pulmonary edema and carcinoma of the right maxilla. And why, for the rest of her life, Anna Freud found the entire situation extremely difficult, as she pointed out in this letter of 12 October 1964 to Schur. Dass es für mich ja doch immer schwierig ist. Now things become even more interesting, and definitely become more complicated, when we start investigating what happened after Freud reminded Schur of their agreement. In the penultimate paragraph of Freud Living and Dying, Schur wrote, I quote, I informed Anna of our conversation, as Freud had asked. In all likelihood, this should read, I discussed Freud's request to have his life ended with Anna, and she agreed for me to proceed. When he was again in agony, I gave him a hypodermic of 2 centigrams of morphine. He soon felt relief and fell into a peaceful sleep. The expression of pain and suffering was gone. I repeated this dose after about 12 hours. Freud was obviously so close to the end of his reserves that he lapsed into a coma and didn't wake up again. He died at 3 a.m. on September the 23rd, 1939, unquote. Hence, according to this official version of Freud's dying days, Schur administered 2 morphine injections of 2 centigrams each, with an interval of 12 hours. Yet Schur's unpublished typescript of his medical case history of Sigmund Freud in the Library of Congress is different. This is what the typescript says. Quote, I informed Anna of this conversation between himself and Freud. When on the following day he was again in agony of pain, I gave him a hypodermic with a normal dose of 2 centigrams, 1/3 of a grain of morphine. He soon felt relief and fell into a peaceful sleep. The expression of pain and suffering was gone. He was obviously so close to the end of all his reserves that he lapsed into a coma and didn't wake up anymore. He died September 23, unquote. Apart from the fact that the typescript doesn't mention a time of death, it only makes reference to 1 injection. This is the account that Jones would have relied on when he prepared the 3rd volume of his Freud biography. And so he repeated it almost verbatim. This is Jones. Whilst also adding the time of Freud's death as just before midnight. Quote, the next morning, Schur gave Freud 1/3 of a grain of morphia. For someone at such a point of exhaustion as Freud then was, and so complete a stranger to opiates, that small dose sufficed. He sighed with relief and sank into a peaceful sleep. He was evidently close to the end of his reserves. He died just before midnight the next day, September the 23rd, 1939. Unquote. 1 or 2 injections. Schur's manuscript of Freud's medical case history complicates matters further. In this document, Schur wrote, quote, when on the following day, we need to assume the 22nd of September, he was again in an agony of pain, I gave him a hypodermic with 3 centigrams of morphine. He soon felt relief and fell into a peaceful sleep. The expression of pain and suffering was gone. After some hours, he became somewhat restless, his breathing more laborious. I gave another dose, and the last one on the following day. He died on September 23, unquote. Again, it should be noted here that Schur did not include an exact or even approximate time of death. But the most striking discrepancies between this manuscript and the typescript concern the number of injections and the dosage. In the manuscript, Schur referred to 3 separate doses of morphine, 2 administered on the 22nd and 1 final dose administered on the 23rd. And contradicting his own subsequent measure of the dosage in the typescript and in the published book, he indicated here in the manuscript a dosage of 3 centigrams for the 1st injection, without specifying the amounts for the 2nd and the 3rd. Now, over the years, it is this, It is this last version by Shaw, which may have been the first, chronologically, which has become the standard account of how Freud's final wish was granted. Partly, no doubt, because 3 centigrams of morphine is considered a lethal dose, especially for a frail and elderly patient, and especially when twice repeated. Partly because Shaw's manuscript of Freud's medical case history is generally deemed to contain the most authentic chronicle of events, the one that wouldn't have yet been modified following the advice of Shaw's lawyer, who could have recommended that the amount of 3 centigrams be reduced to 1 injection of 2 centigrams in accordance with the common medical dosage of morphine administered for the relief of severe pain. It is this version which has appeared in Gay's biography of Freud. Although Gay put the timing of the first injection on Thursday the 21st of September, thus taking the liberty of ignoring Shaw's indication that it occurred the following day, i.e. the day after his death pact with Freud had been activated. Presumably because Gay found it difficult to reconcile Shaw's timings here with Freud's death at 3 a.m. on Saturday morning. In Mark Edmondson's narrative of Freud's final days, The Death of Sigmund Freud, it is again claimed that Shaw administered the first injection of 3 centigrams of morphine on 21 September, followed by a second one of unspecified dosage in the same day, and a third one again of unspecified dosage on the 22nd. In his annotations to Freud's diary of the final decade, Michael Molnar indicates, quote, Shaw gave Freud a morphine injection without specifying the dosage and on which day it was administered, to which he adds it was twice repeated the following day. In Elisabeth Rudinesco's most recent biographical study, Shaw's involvement is described in quite general terms, although here it is insinuated that each of the 3 injections contained 3 centigrams of morphine. However, we are once again left wondering about how much truth is contained in the housekeeper's story. This aged servant, Paula Fichtel, whose recollections constitute a document that, according to the trained historian, surely should not be trusted implicitly. Talking to Detlef Bertelsen in the kitchen of Maresfield Gardens, downstairs, over a cup of coffee and a good slice of homemade Linzer Nussdochter. Doesn't it look delicious? On those weekends when Anna Freud was not around, she said to Bertelsen, don't come when Anna's around because she really doesn't like me when I talk to strangers. So we'll find a weekend when she's not around. Talking to Bertelsen, Paula Fichtel first of all disclosed how Freud had at one point reminded his doctor Shaw of their former agreement, and how he had insisted that Shaw discuss the matter with Anna rather than Marta. Discuss. Die Paula recalled how Anna was seized with emotion. Anna Freud ist aufgelöst. Aufgelöst. How she had wanted her father to stay alive, but how she eventually felt that her father's will was more important than her own. Now, as I pointed out earlier, the only mention of Freud's exhortation to Shaw that he should consult with Anna before proceeding to execute the pact appears in the manuscript of Shaw's medical case history of Freud. It is extremely unlikely that Paula Fichtel would have read this document, because I have no evidence that Shaw ever forwarded a copy to Anna Freud, and even if he did, it would have required Paula Fichtel nosing around Anna Freud's private papers. Given how close Paula Fichtel had become to the family, it is much more likely that Freud's request to Shaw and Anna Freud's very painful dilemma is what Paula Fichtel witnessed firsthand during those final days in 20 Maresfield Gardens. As mentioned earlier, Fichtel then told Bertelsen how Shaw had left for America on the morning of the 23rd, yet not before administering a small dose of morphine, and how he had been replaced with Dr. Josephine Schoss. Now, for reasons I explained earlier on, it is impossible that Shaw administered the first dose on the morning of the 23rd, regardless as to what happened afterwards in the library of 20 Maresfield Gardens. Yet the rest of Fichtel's story is not substantially different from the typescript of Shaw's medical case history of Freud. Here you have both compared. This is Paul Fichtel's account. This is Max Shaw in the typescript of the medical case history of Sigmund Freud in the Library of Congress. Both stories are not substantially different in as much as they both mention just one injection, containing a non-lethal dose of 2 centigrams of morphine administered on the 22nd of September, we need to assume. And because this is the version which Jones employed for his report on Freud's final days, Fichtel's story also tallies with Jones's account, with the caveat that the injection would have been given on the 22nd rather than the 23rd. After Shaw's 1964 Freud lecture, and especially after the publication of his book in 1972, both the typescript version of the events and Jones's retelling of it became gradually obsolete. Yet when the manuscript of Shaw's medical history became available to researchers, this in turn superseded the book's story as a more truthful record of Freud's death. On at least two occasions, Shaw mentioned that the typescript of Freud's medical case history had remained inaccurate with regard to the morphine dosage and the number of injections Freud had been given. On the 7th of April 1954, Shaw wrote to Jones to inform him that he had sent the original version of the case history, by which he presumably meant the first version of the typescript, i.e. the version that hadn't been altered on the solicitor's advice, to Anna. Shaw went on to state, quote, "This version, the original version of the typescript, describes the facts accurately. Page 45, however, as far as dosage and number of injections is concerned, is inaccurate. I deposited the accurate description with the Freud archives in the Library of Congress." Unquote. On the same day, Shaw wrote to Anna Freud to say that he was sending her the original versions of the 2 pages of the typescript as they had been written before the modification suggested by the legal counsel. But again, he added that page 45 would refer to the number and dosage of injections had not been changed, but that the correct version had been handed over to the archives. Now, all of this is rather confusing. But until now, it's always been assumed that the correct version corresponds to the manuscript version of Shaw's medical case history of Freud. Yet for all I've been able to ascertain, and maybe Michael will contradict me, Shaw himself never formally or informally designated the manuscript version as the correct version. In other words, there is no evidence that the manuscript is de facto what Shaw referred to as the correct account. And it is questionable whether anyone would want to leave behind the most accurate record of events in handwritten form, but that's another matter. Furthermore, as we have seen, although Freud historians have generally considered Shaw's manuscript to be the most authentic version, they have nonetheless believed to be unreliable in terms of the timing of the injection, which Gay and others have actually changed from the 22nd to the 21st. If Shaw's timings in the manuscript must have been incorrect, at least if we continue to assume that Freud died at 3 a.m. on the 23rd of September, why would the other details be more reliable? If Shaw's first injection contained the lethal dose of 3 centigrams of morphine, why would he have had to repeat it? Not once, but twice, given that 3 centigrams of morphine is a lethal dose. And isn't it a standard requirement for a correct medical record to be also accurate and complete? If the manuscript is the correct version, why doesn't it include the exact timings for the injections? Why doesn't it include the exact dosages for the second and the third injections? Why doesn't it include the exact time of Freud's death? What if the answer to these questions is exceedingly simple? Shaw's manuscript of Freud's medical case history does not contain these details because it is not the most truthful version of what happened during Freud's dying days. Let us return to the kitchen of 20 Maresfield Gardens, where Paul Fichtel is again talking to Detlef Bertelsen over a cup of coffee and another good slice of homemade Nusstorte. Sure, she recalls, injected a small dose of morphine, which had sent Freud to sleep, and then Shaw vamoosed, in search of safety and security on the other side of the Atlantic. Fichtel would have had no reason whatsoever to protect Shaw. Like he himself would have wanted to protect himself against prosecution when he consulted a lawyer during the early 1950s. Paul Fichtel is unlikely to have known much about the difference between a small and a large dosage of morphine. But she may have overheard a conversation about Shaw giving Freud some pain relief, much like she knew about Anna Freud's involvement in the execution of the Death Pact. More importantly, Fichtel wouldn't have had any reason to lie to Bertelsen about Shaw's sudden departure from the scene. On the contrary, she would have had every reason to confirm yet lie about Shaw's presence until the final hour. Because in doing so, she would have simply repeated what was to some extent already in the public domain through Jones's biography and Shaw's 1964 lecture at the New York Psychoanalytic, and because in not doing so, she would be deliberately incriminating other people. Shaw, for his part, would have had every reason to quote-unquote forget about his departure and to lie about his ongoing presence even in the manuscript. For one, because admitting that he had left the scene would not have made him innocent in the whole affair, since he did administer one injection. For two, because it would have made Freud's death more suspicious and potentially incriminate other people. And most important of all, because admitting that he had left the scene would have implied that he, Max Shaw, Freud's loyal personal physician, had effectively failed to execute the death pact. If Fichtel was right about Shaw, it would make the typescript of Shaw's medical case history of Freud actually more accurate than the manuscript, at least in terms of the dosage of morphine that Shaw himself injected. Pouring another cup of coffee and a slice of Nussdorte, Fichtel continued. Back at his bedside is Dr. Schoss, who waited with a second injection until the professor regained consciousness again. The day goes by, but Freud is still breathing. Go and have another look at Herr Professor, Anna asks Paula. Bertelsen is reporting, right? But he was already unconscious. The four women, his companions in emigration, waited at his bedside for half of the night. Not until 3 in the morning, more than 36 hours after the injection, did Freud die, without ever regaining consciousness, unquote. Again, Fichtel would have had no reason to exonerate Shaw and incriminate Josephine Schoss, who was still alive when this conversation took place. On the contrary, she would have had no reason to lie about the extent of Shaw's involvement, assuming, ladies and gentlemen, that lying is what housekeepers do in the first place. Of course, it should also be noted here that Fichtel did not actually say that Josephine Strauss did give Freud the final injection. She merely suggested that Dr. Strauss had waited until the time when the professor regained consciousness, without clarifying, it's there in front of you, you can all read, without clarifying whether he actually did, and whether Dr. Strauss proceeded accordingly. Coming to my conclusion. The archive of Josephine Strauss at the Freud Museum London, here in this building, which mainly includes letters exchanged between her, Anna Freud, and Dorothy Burlingham, they do not reveal any more details about her precise involvement of Freud's death, whatever Elisabeth Rudinesco may be hoping for. To the best of my knowledge, Josephine Schoss did not leave behind a private diary, and if she did, it wasn't included in the cache of documents that were bequeathed to us here at the Freud Museum in 2005 by N.J. Smith on behalf of Josephine Schoss's relative, Michael Stanley. The only source corroborating Paula Fichtel's account and confirming Josephine Strauss as the one who administered the final and fatal injection to Freud is Michael Molnar, who remembers Josephine Strauss. I don't want to put you in a picture, but there you go. I guess I do now. Who remembers Josephine Strauss herself saying at some museum event or other that Shaw had been too much in awe of Freud to fulfill his promise and had thus acted as a coward, which had left her, Josephine Strauss, in charge of the dying man, and which had eventually led her to administering the final dose of morphine. Michael Molnar claims he himself had no reason to disbelieve Strauss's own version. And in light of what I've tried to show, as regards the great many discrepancies, omissions, and inaccuracies in the existing records, but more importantly, in light of my personal respect for Michael Molnar, I have no reason to disbelieve it either. To many of you, all of this may just be a matter of morbid curiosity, academic detail, or historical technicalities. And the whole truth of what happened during the days before Yom Kippur 1939 will no doubt remain embedded forever in a structure of fiction. As Freud himself put it in an oft-quoted letter of the 31st of May 1936 to Arnold Zweig, which was written in response to Zweig wishing to become Freud's biographer, quote, this is Freud writing to Zweig. Anyone who writes a biography is committed to lies, concealments, hypocrisy, flattery, and even to hiding his own lack of understanding, for biographical truth does not exist. And if it did, we couldn't use it. Truth is unobtainable. Mankind doesn't deserve it. And in any case, is not Prince Hamlet right when he asks who would escape a good whipping were he used after his dessert, unquote. So here is yet another biographical fiction about Freud. It may not replace previous fictions as a better, more accurate, more truthful, or more authentic fiction, but it may demonstrate the fictitiousness of allegedly truthful records. And it may make us appreciate how even the most well-established accounts of Freud's dying days are but fictitious components of a large-scale historical narrative. On Thursday, the 21st of September 1939, Sigmund Freud reminded his doctor, Max Shaw, of the pact they had made back in 1928. That when the time would come, he would not let him suffer unnecessarily. And that he would agree to initiate a process of assisted dying. Freud then asked Shaw to discuss his request with his youngest daughter, Anna. And Shaw dutifully obliged. Anna didn't want her father to be put to death, yet she felt that her will was less important than his. And so she eventually agreed to her father's request, which also made her morally responsible for his death, and which made it next to impossible for her to talk about the events for the rest of her life. Yet Max Shaw could not bring himself to committing the deed, or to seeing the whole process through to the very end. And so sometime during the late morning of Thursday, the 21st of September 1939, he did not inject the patient with a lethal dose of morphine, but with a mere 2 centigrams, a common dose for pain relief. After that, he left Maresfield Gardens, with the explanation that he had to make arrangements for his imminent departure to New York. Shaw's injection sent Freud into a deep sleep, but he didn't die. Looking for someone to replace Shaw, Anna called upon Dr. Josephine Strauss, her pediatrician, a friend who had looked after her father during the long journey from Vienna to London, notably as a replacement for Shaw. Dr. Strauss arrived sometime during the afternoon of Thursday, the 21st of September 1939, and she spent the night from Thursday to Friday and the following day and night at Maresfield Gardens. During those fateful hours, Freud was visited by various family members, but on Friday night, there were only five women in the house. Marta Freud, her sister Minna, who was severely ill, Anna Freud, the housekeeper Paula Fichtel, and Dr. Josephine Strauss. When Freud seemed to regain consciousness and became restless, Dr. Strauss, who knew about the pact because Anna Freud had informed her, Dr. Strauss administered another injection of morphine. It may not have mattered all that much as to how strong the morphine was. But Freud died at 3 a.m. on the 23rd of September 1939. The family felt that it was better for an external doctor to certify the death. After all, Dr. Strauss was a pediatrician and should not run the risk of becoming implicated in a case of euthanasia, which in all likelihood would have landed her a severe prison sentence. Georg Exner, who had treated Freud in London for his cancer and who knew about his patient's incurable illness, was called in. And Exner declared that Freud had died of pulmonary edema and carcinoma of the right maxilla, in accordance with what the professor's medical records would already have extensively documented. On Monday the 25th of September 1939, Ernst Freud registered the death of his father in the registration district of Hampstead. Freud was cremated at Golders Green Crematorium during the morning of Tuesday the 26th. News of Freud's death was announced on the radio in various parts of the world on Sunday the 24th of September. And throughout the following weeks, newspapers around the world published tributes to the deceased founder of psychoanalysis, each with their own share of biographical fiction. "Freud foretold his death," stated the Birmingham Gazette. "Freud dies, father of psychoanalysis," said a headline in the Daily Herald. Death happens. Yet the line and the story underneath would have definitely captured the attention. Quote, "Study of Hitler unfinished." The paragraph underneath would have definitely been even more sensational. I'm not sure you can read it depending where you are. The Daily Herald said, "Had the world's greatest mind expert lived only a short time longer, he would have pronounced and published his views on the world's most dangerous mind, that of Hitler. Freud had often expressed his private view on Hitler's mind. He was known to have made notes about his studies and had been pressed to publish them. There is still a possibility that his son and daughter, who were his close collaborators, may tell the world about their father's research." Unquote. Unlike housekeepers, ladies and gentlemen, journalists are not known to be particularly interested in the truth. Not even when they are employed by respectable magazines such as Time. Because there is absolutely no evidence that Freud's New York-based nephew Edward Bernays ever suggested that his uncle should leave Austria for America. As Time wrote all those years ago. Maybe sometimes historians, including the most authoritative historians, maybe sometimes historians act too much like journalists and not enough like housekeepers. Maybe sometimes historians could benefit from a cup of coffee and a good slice of Linzer Nussdokter. Thank you very much.
Bursting with questions, but I wonder if we should give first right of response to Michael Molnar, since you've been quoted so liberally.
Yes.
It would be interesting to hear your views on Danny's interpretation of events.
I'm a bit bewildered by being deferred to so much as an authority. I mean,
do you want a microphone, Mike? Maybe people at the back.
Maybe stand up. Do you want to stand up?
I'm a bit bewildered by being referred to as an authority, especially in relation to the key fact, of course, which I told Danny, which was Josephine Schnors, had actually told me that she had given the final injection. Now, this was 30 years or so ago, and I'm even now, the more weight, historical weight that is being put on that single remark that I heard, I begin to doubt myself. Did I really hear this? Am I a victim of some sort of false memory? And the corollary of that is, you go beyond, was Josephine Storrs, who was in turn 30 or 40 years away from the events, was she inventing, remembering falsely or whatever? I do remember her sitting in the library and being asked by the first curators of this museum whether she could remember how the room looked in 1939 at the time of Freud's death. They were trying to establish, to recreate the library as it was. And she turned to the bookshelves and said they weren't there. Unfortunately, there are photos that show that these bookshelves were there, and the curator had to tell her in a rather bashed tone that we had proof they were there. And she was very dejected and said, I can't remember anything anymore. So the whole question comes down to memories, and obviously in this case we are in a twilight zone. I mean, I know there's a study called Thanatology nowadays, which in fact Freud referred to in Beyond the Pleasure Principle. I think he's referring to Weismann, who in fact disputes whether there is a sharp contrast between life and death. And this is in fact one of the arguments of Freud, that there is no sharp distinction between what is living and what is dead. The body goes on growing after the mind is gone, for instance. And in certain areas of life, in viruses, hard to say whether they're mineral or what form of life they are. But life and death are indistinguishable, in the same way I think reality and memory become confused. So I am confused with my memories, but yes, Josephine Schnors did, to the best of my knowledge, and swearing upon the complete works of Freud, did tell me that she had given a final injection. And I was very glad to hear that Danny has now put this in the historical realm, and I'd like to thank him for this bewildering and fascinating tour.
Thank you, Mike. Thank you.
I was struck by how Pyrrhendelian the whole procedure was. It is so animated. But so one thing I wanted to pick up with was this death at 3 a.m. of Jewish Sabbath and the possibilities of myth making in relation to that. And in fact, something that might have been in the complete works. Obviously, he's in.
Yes, sure. Sure. How many times am I going to say sure tonight? I've said it too many times already. Look, Jones dates is 20:45. And that's in itself strange, because for that last chapter of his third volume of his Freud biography, he relies on Shaw's typescript. But Shaw's typescript doesn't include a date. So in all likelihood, Jones relied on Marie Bonaparte, who of course wasn't there. The 3 a.m. thing...
I'm thinking 3 p.m. on Good Friday.
But 3 p.m. On Good Friday is quite unlikely. Because if you look at the newspaper announcement, the newspaper reports around the time...
No, but I'm thinking, I suppose I'm getting a bit Freudian here.
Yes.
But yes. Thinking of that cultural makeup.
Well, look, but Saturday, the 23rd of September 1939, was Yom Kippur.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
So much has been made about the fact that Freud died on Yom Kippur. So much so that people have said, well, it was a plan. Yeah, we've read that one before. It's not that Freud foretold his own death, but he arranged it in such a way that he would die on the Day of Atonement. There is no evidence in my historical research that it was planned like that. Mm-hmm. Whether he died at 3 a.m. or later, I'm not entirely sure, but I think we have good reasons to believe that it was the 23rd of September. So I don't want to take it as far as disputing that it was the 22nd. It couldn't have been the 24th. Because of the letters and the announcements, you know, it could have been earlier, but in all likelihood, well, no, it couldn't have been later.
No, the point is, it doesn't matter if it was.
Well, maybe it doesn't matter.
The probability of having the 3 a.m.
Well, but with the caveat that Peter Gay, when he reads the manuscript of Shaw's medical case history of Sigmund Freud, he changes it. He changes Shaw's timings because he obviously thinks, well, it cannot possibly be true. I'll take the Nussdorter away, right? So Gay says it cannot possibly be true that the 22nd of September was the day of the first injection. If you follow the rest of the story. Right? Because the rest of the story is, I gave another dose, and the last one, on the following day. On 27. So in terms of time, it doesn't make sense. It really doesn't make sense. From the assumption that he indeed died on the third, on at 3 a.m. on the 23rd.
What we would
have heard if we'd heard the lecture the year before.
When you were going to talk about the aftermath of the death.
Well, okay, I can, there's another paper here, but, you know, you've probably had enough already. The immediate aftermath is that there's a great many news reports on the radio, in the written press. And when you look through, actually, I'm not sure whether you can read this, but you see, some of you may have picked up on that. So the Daily Herald also says, Herr Martin Freud, the professor's elder son, said yesterday that his father had passed away quietly and peacefully when the clock struck midnight. On the 23rd. Now, if you want to believe that, why would you want to believe? I mean, Freud, correct me if I'm wrong, Michael, never made any notes about Hitler, never intended to publish a book on Hitler. So they made it all up.
I think they've confused Hitler with Woodrow Wilson, maybe.
Precisely, as you would, right? As you would, you know. I mean, it's a confusion easy to make. Right? It's easy to make. So the newspapers, they start reporting. And it's really interesting to see how different newspapers in different countries report Freud's death. Many newspapers, and I don't have time today to take you through this, but many newspapers in Britain say, and he wanted to be British. But sadly, it didn't happen. Which is true, by the way. So many newspapers in Britain, they refer to the fact that Britain had welcomed Professor Freud, and that, you know, it's so typical for the British press, isn't it? So we welcome Professor Freud, and then, when he's here, we actually stop him from realizing his wish to become British. If you look at the French, the Dutch, and the Belgian press, both the French-speaking part of Belgium and the Flemish-speaking part of Belgium, they're extremely critical of Freud's theories. So they take advantage of Freud's passing in order to pass judgment on psychoanalysis. Now, why is that? Now, it's because those countries, particularly Belgium and France, were Roman Catholic countries. And within Roman Catholicism, at the time, in 1939, it was still believed that psychoanalysis was anathema. So there's a lot, so in terms of the immediate aftermath, if you look at the reporting, you get a sense, beyond the lies and the biographical fictions, of how the prevailing ideologies and religions within the various countries accepted or indeed did not accept Freud's discoveries. And you can learn certain things about that, about the reception of Freudian psychoanalysis in Europe around the late 1930s. Needless to say, there aren't that many German newspapers who reported extensively on Freud's death. Yeah, so I showed you one. I'm not going to take you through all the slides again, but there aren't that many. So you understand why. So that's just a little snippet of the immediate aftermath.
And when you tell me?
Yes, the Italian newspapers, they roughly adhere to the idea. Actually, there's one Italian newspaper, I think it's the Corriere della Sera, that refers, I'm still doing some research on it, to an edict by the Pope. They refer to the fact that the Pope at the time had issued an edict banning psychoanalysis because he had deemed it irreconcilable with the Roman Catholic faith. Right? I mean, it's a little avenue that is still worth pursuing.
I was fascinated by the Anna Freud's letter to Schur.
Yes.
You were going to say something about the underlying of the message.
Yes. Okay. Well, let's go back. Yeah. Yeah. So what is underlined? You can just about see it in blue ballpoint. In blue ballpoint. What is underlined is, okay, I'll read it in German. Eine kleine Bemerkung, a small remark. Sollte Dr. Strauss nicht auch dein vorkommen? Should Dr. Strauss not also appear? She means in Shaw's talk. Sie war sehr unentbehrlich, very indispensable, auf den Reisen und in den letzten Nächten, both during the journey and during the, it's plural, yeah, plural. She said, during the last nights, die sie ganz geteilt hat, which she shared to the full. I don't know who underlined this. I mean, maybe Michael has something to say about this. Maybe someone who looked at these documents before us underlined it. God forbid. I want to believe it's not the case, because we tend to keep an eye on what people do with our archives when they actually look through them. Is it the recipient or is it the sender who underlined it? Anna Freud was extremely meticulous. I mean, the Anna Freud archives are very meticulously documented and organized. Did she at one point revisit this letter and decided to underline it in blue? I don't know. I have absolutely no idea. But it's just about, I mean, maybe Monica has something to say about it. I mean, this is just about the most significant sentence of the entire letter. It goes on, by the way. This is not the end of the letter. I'm not going to take you through all the rest of that. So she talks about Shaw's paper that he wants to get published. But if there's one sentence that is significant, it would be this one.
Can I just make a comment? Fascinating, and all the twists and turns of this detective story. But you talked of Dr. Shaw's reasons why he might have covered up what you think could have been the truth, and mainly because he was, you think he was, did not want to be accused of euthanasia.
Mm.
But it seems to me there could be a completely different reason, which is that he,
Shaw,
wanted to be thought of as the loyal, trusted physician. And it doesn't look very good that he disappeared a couple of days.
No, exactly. I didn't mention that. I mean, maybe in the
and
way I can...
want to give Josephine Strauss any credit for having...
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I do say in the paper, but I probably went through it too quickly, and the arguments were probably flowing in too many directions at the same time. But I did point out that Shaw had every reason not to mention his departure. Right, because he was involved anyway. He probably did administer an injection. So whether he left or not, he was already involved. And in not mentioning his departure to himself and to others, he could continue to express his loyalty to Professor Freud, and he wouldn't have had to live, at least not in writing, with the fact that he had failed to execute the pact upon which they had shook hands.
But I was thinking more that he would want other people to think of him as, oh, how wonderful, how loyal he stayed with to the end.
No doubt. No doubt. Yes, no doubt.
And I think this underlining is something to tell, to be not too direct. So Anna tells with this underlining something in between the lines. For me, I read it in this way. She's not open there. You were not there.
Yeah.
But she wrote die sie ganz geteilt möchte.
Die sie ganz
geteilt. So she was there the whole time.
The whole time. With,
and who was not? So I think.
By the way, maybe I should have worked for Scotland Yard. But when you look at this, there's more than an underlining. I hope you can see this.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's this as well.
Yeah.
As if the underlining was not enough, someone also decided to do this.
The same
highlight the paragraph.
No.
Not in the same.
No. I'm not entirely sure how it got here. I'm not entirely sure. Because this was sent to Mark Shaw.
Yeah. Hmm?
So it's a very good question.
Anna always made copies of letters she wrote to me.
She did.
So
she did.
Is it a copy of her own letter?
But they're not the forensic test. It wasn't the same pen.
Maybe we should ask Patricia Cornwell to have a look at this. and see what a forensic examination can reveal, not only about the nature of the ink here, but about when this annotation would have been made, whether it was made around the same time as the letter was written, or whether it would be at a much later date. I mean, what would it tell us? I'm not entirely sure what would it tell us. Fact of the matter is, just about the most important sentence in this letter is underlined not once, but twice.
It's also a faint typescript
I'm not exactly sure. You're all interested now, aren't you? I'm not exactly sure what that is.
It's legible.
I'm sorry, Mike. I can't read it from here. I can't. Yes. I can't. Sorry. Alan.
interested. Let's go back to Shaw and how he used some of the story in the place where he did publish it.
Yes. The book Freud Living and Dying. This is Shaw Freud. Yeah. This is the published book. It was published posthumously, but okay.
Well, I'm not going to ask him. He's part of the answer. So, what is that? Did that actually benefit him or give him public persona? People, how people react when that book was published, describing his important role in fibrosis to Freud.
The short answer is, I don't know. I don't know. I haven't looked at reviews of Shaw's book. I haven't looked at how it was received. It's interesting, of course, that his 1964 lecture to the New York Psychoanalytic was never published. There is an abstract, well, more than an abstract, there's a synopsis of it in the Psychoanalytic Quarterly, a three-page synopsis of Shaw's lecture. The lecture itself was never published, but there's at least five, six versions of it in the Library of Congress, or of this lecture. But the reason I'm saying that is that I'm also not entirely sure how people reacted to his lecture in 1964, which is roughly similar to what ended up in the book. So, I mean, it's a good point. I would need to look into that. But you see, I mean, when you look at this, given that 2 centigrams of morphine is not a lethal dose, so that's generally regarded to be a medical dose administered for the relief of severe pain. Of course, he says, I repeated this dose, 12 hours, right? So he gave 2 injections, but still, he could have argued that the dose that he had administered was not lethal. And after all, Exner said he had died of the carcinoma of the right jaw, right? So on the basis of what is... So the only place where you could... on the basis of which you could hold Shaw accountable is this. That's the manuscript. So that's the handwritten, the holograph of the medical case history of Freud. Because here he says 3 centigrams. That's a lethal dose. But obviously that was never published.
That's how I died earlier.
But what? Exactly, that's what I said. So if he administered a lethal dose of 3 centigrams, why would he have had to give 2 others? I mean, given Freud's condition, 3 centigrams of morphine probably would have killed him.
Is he injected it all at once? I've known people who died at home, where the doctor has left a half dose hypodermic in the house after having, you know, this is recently, so they have to count for it, but they didn't inject the whole amount at once. They left the other half of the vial in the fridge, and so could he sure have left some of the morphine? Could Josephine have signed the poison book for morphine? Did she carry morphine if she was a pediatrician? Or could sure have left some morphine? And could that be some of the cause of the end?
I don't know. Yes, precisely. The truth is, I don't know. And that is the truth.
Yeah.
Because were I to know, I would tell you. Look, that's where we are. And I hope you got intrigued a little bit by this. And maybe the historian or the detective on you want to have another look at the archives. Fact of the matter is that there's still quite a bit that is unclear, and that will no doubt remain unclear, despite the fact that we tend to think that Gay's account, which also reappears in Rudinesco's book, is now the definitive version of how Freud died. Right? So, as I said, I didn't come here with the intention of telling you
a more authentic or a more truthful version, but simply to give you a sense of how what we believe to be the truth may to some extent, maybe to a large extent, also be fictitious and part of a biographical fictitious narrative. That's all really.
And I think that's probably a very good moment at which to stop and for me to thank you for extraordinary piece of historiographical research and detective work and analysis of all sorts. Might be appropriate as well just to say, as it happens, our next exhibition, which is starting next week by two artists called Bloomberg and Chanry, they actually did forensic work on the couch. So, I have used some of that forensic work to produce some material. So a very different forensic approach, but there we are. But, I think we ought to invite you back next year for Bloomberg and find out some more. But thank you very much.
Thank you so much.